Appreciate everyone's presence today. I know we have some who are visiting with us today. We are really glad you're here. Of course, today is celebrated as Easter Sunday. And it may be that you're here because it's Easter Sunday. And we're glad to have you here. We're not going to do anything special today or any kind of special activities because of that. But we're really glad that you're here. And if you're here because it's Easter Sunday, we hope that you'll plan to come back tonight and next week and the next week. And so we really appreciate everyone's presence this morning. Begin by turning your attention to Genesis chapter 1 today. Genesis chapter 1, we're not going to stay there very long. But we're going to use that to introduce our thoughts this morning. In Genesis 1, verse 26, it says, God said, "Let us make man in our image according to our likeness. Let them rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. So in the beginning, God created a man and a woman. He created a male and a female. Now we read more about the details of that creation in Genesis chapter 1. He created the man from the dust of the ground, and he created woman from one of the ribs of the man that he had created. God didn't create a sort of a unisex human being, and then later divide the man from the woman, but he created a man, and then a little bit later on, he created a woman. Two human beings, each with a sexual identity of his own or her own. Throughout the Bible, men are taught to maintain their sexual identity, their manhood. Women are taught to maintain their sexual identity, their womanhood. And you can see that as we trace this a little bit through the Bible. In Genesis chapter 3, God places upon the man, he addresses the man after the introduction of sin. He addresses the man and places upon him certain responsibilities. And then he addresses the woman and places upon her certain responsibilities as well. When you go into the law of Moses, you'll find that men are to behave like men and they are to look like men. For example, the Bible tells us in Deuteronomy chapter 22 and verse 5, under the law of Moses, men were not to dress like women. And today you have men who dress like women. They want to appear as though they are women. I think that's the thing he's talking about in that place. And women are not to dress like men. Men are to dress like men. And so men are to do the responsibilities that God gave men. They are to look like men. They're to present themselves as men. Women are to fulfill the responsibilities that God gave women, and they are to present themselves as women. And so men maintain their sexual identity. Women are to maintain their sexual identity as well. Leviticus 18, men are told not to lie with other men as they would lie with a woman. And so men are to remain, again, to maintain their sexual identity in this context, and not to lie with a man as he would lie with a woman. Paul describes this kind of behavior as contrary to nature. Romans chapter 1, verse 26. Now, if doing something contrary to nature makes it sinful, and that's what Paul seems to imply in Romans chapter 1, verse 26 about homosexuality being contrary to nature, surely a man who tries to alter the sexual identity he was born with has done something contrary to nature. If anything's contrary to nature, that's contrary to nature. And if doing what is contrary to nature is sinful, Romans 1, 26, well then, for a man to alter his sexual identity, like people are doing today, and a woman to alter her sexual identity, would be sinful. Paul addresses men and women separately in certain passages. Titus chapter 2, verses 1 through 8. He addresses the older men and the younger men and the older women and the younger women. He gives certain responsibilities to husbands and fathers and other responsibilities to wives and mothers. I want to talk a little bit especially about the responsibilities of men as reflected in the Bible. What should a man be? As far as the Bible is concerned, what should a man be? How should a man behave? How should a man act or react? How should a man present himself to others? What sort of persona should he project? How should a man think? What should a man's attitude be toward other people? How should he think about women? How should he treat women? How should he think about the world around him? How should he think about money and power and position and influence and prestige? If men do not act like men should act, the result is going to be harmful. It's going to be harmful to himself. It's going to be harmful to his family. And it's going to be harm to the culture at large. I think we've got a manhood problem in the world. But we need to think, at least think about it. I suspect you could write an entire book about biblical manhood, and I imagine somebody's already done it. I'd be surprised if somebody hasn't done it yet. But we need to think about being a man, a biblical, scriptural, godly man. And that's different from what the world thinks a man should be. Where should we go to learn about what a man should be? Well, I suppose ideally a boy should be able to look to his father to learn what a man ought to be, or maybe his grandfather, or are those men closely related to him? But unfortunately, that's not an option for many boys. Either the father is completely absent from his life, or the father is not what he ought to be. And so he's learning inappropriate things from his father. And instead of being able to learn from a father, there is a void. And so that void is being filled so often in our world today with terrible, terrible models. And so where is a boy going to learn how to be a man? If he learns from the culture around us, if that's where he's learning how to be a man, well, he's learning some very bad lessons. If he turns to contemporary culture, the picture of a real man that's often portrayed in movies or television or graphic novels or music videos is something like this. A real man is the hard-living, hard-drinking, hard-talking, hard-punching, skirt-chasing man. That's what a real man is. Hard-living, hard-drinking, profanity-filled, skirt-chasing. That's what a real man is, as is portrayed in the culture around us very often. Is a real man the rock and roller? You know, hard living, hard drinking. You know, is that a real man? Is a real man the country music real man? Again, hard drinking, skirt chasing kind of man. Is that a real man? Is a real man a thug, a gangster, whose image and credibility and manhood are enhanced by the money, women, and guns he owns and by the time he served? In some people's eyes, that's a real man. If you've served some time, that's what makes you a real man. Those are the lessons that are being portrayed to our boys in the culture around us. Where should we go to learn what a man ought to be? Well, godly men will go to God's book to find the answer. And when we go to God's book, there is no better man to imitate than Jesus himself. Sometimes people talk about the message of the Bible and the gospel as being radically countercultural. Well, if there's anything radically countercultural, it is that Jesus is the ideal model for a real man. So if you were to ask a lot of people, what do you think a real man is? I'm not sure how many of them would say, well, I tell you what, Jesus is a real man. They'd look to other things. A lot of people would. But if you want to be a godly man, well, there's no better man to imitate than Jesus. So what I want to do in our time together is to look at three passages in the Bible, in the New Testament, that describe the character of Jesus. And I hope that we can at least begin to think about what a real man is, what a man's man is, as far as the Bible is concerned, or what a godly man is. And again, I just hope to get us to begin thinking about these things. This is not an exhaustive study, to say the least. Well, let's go to Jesus' own description of himself. Matthew chapter 11. Matthew 11, Jesus, it's really a passage that deals with the authority that Jesus has. Begins in verse 25, Matthew 11, verse 25. Jesus said, I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you've hidden these things from the wise and intelligent and revealed them to infants. Yes, Father, for this way was pleasing in your sight. All things have been handed over to me by my Father. And no one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son wills to reveal him. And so there Jesus speaks about the unique relationship that he has with the Father because of the union that they have between themselves. No one knows the Father like the Son knows the Father, and no one knows the Son like the Father knows the Son. And then the Son is able to reveal the Father to those who are willing to learn. And so then Jesus says, well, come to me. This is Matthew's version of, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except by me. This is sort of Matthew's version of that. And so no one knows the Father except the Son. No one knows the Son except the Father. And the Son will reveal these things to whoever is willing to listen. So come to me. Come to me. I'm really the only source that you have for accurate knowledge of the Father. And so he's speaking about his authority. Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart, and you'll find rest unto your souls. My yoke is easy, my burden is light. Someone might think about, well, take a yoke. That sounds awfully oppressive, you know. A yoke is what you put on an animal as he's plowing the earth, and you put this yoke upon. That's a sort of to keep him in line. And so you're going to put something restrictive on me and something oppressive on me. That sounds awfully difficult and harsh. But Jesus goes on to say, take my yoke upon you, for I am gentle. Not anything restrictive, not anything oppressive, not anything harsh to bear. For I'm gentle and humble in heart, and you'll find rest to your souls. So Jesus describes himself as gentle and humble. Now what should a man be? Well, if he's going to be like Jesus, he's going to have to develop some gentleness and some humility, or I'm meek and lowly is what some versions say. So let's talk about that a little bit. The word gentle, this is New American Standard Bible, includes ideas like meekness and humility. A man who is gentle is unassuming and considerate. He's kind. And that's part of being gentle. You can see that. A person who is gentle is considerate and kind. In Galatians chapter 5 and verse 23, this quality is found among the fruits of the Spirit. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 5, the meek shall inherit the earth. And so this quality, if found among men, will be blessed by God. Although it was not a quality very highly prized in the ancient world, the idea of being gentle or meek. In the ancient world, like today's world, the qualities highly prized are aggressiveness and self-confidence and self-assertion. And putting yourself out there and being ambitious. Those were the things, and those are the things that are highly prized. In Matthew 21 and verse 5, this quality is found in the Messiah as he rides on the donkey, rides on the donkey into the city of Jerusalem. Matthew 21 verse 5 says, Say to the daughter of Zion, behold, your king is coming to you gentle and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a beast of burden. We are to have this quality. It should govern us when we preach. And so 2 Corinthians chapter 10, we've studied that recently in our class. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul talks about the fact that he comes to them as a minister of the gospel of Christ with meekness and gentleness. And so this quality ought to govern our preaching. When we respond to others, when we give a reason for the hope that is in us, we are to do it with gentleness. 1 Peter 3, verses 15 and 16. Even when correcting others, 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 25, we are to do it with gentleness or with meekness. We're to bear with one another or forbear each other, put up with each other with meekness or gentleness. Ephesians 4, verses 25. It involves patient submission, even in leaders. So Numbers chapter 21, we find Moses, the leader of Israel, the meekest man on earth. And so even among leaders, we're to find this quality. And so meekness or gentleness doesn't preclude things like preaching and responding to others and correcting others and leading God's people. It doesn't preclude those things, yet meekness ought to characterize us as we engage in those things. To be humble is an attribute of God. The 18th Psalm, verse 35 says, the psalmist says, "Your gentleness made me great." Well, that might be an idea that we don't often associate with God. Your gentleness has made me great. Psalm 18, verse 35. It is a spirit of lowliness that enables God to bring the blessing of advancement. And so those that are humble or those that are lowly will be exalted. And so it's the spirit of lowliness that enables God to raise people up or advance them. And so Jesus describes himself in this way. I'm gentle, I'm humble in heart. I'm meek and lowly in heart. And so we ask these questions. Did Jesus win disciples through intimidation? I tell you what, you will be my disciple. No, that's not how he won disciples. Did he coerce or bully people, even his opponents, into compliance? No, he didn't do that. Did he ever raise his fist to his fellow man? No. Did he ever bow up and put his finger in the face of his opponents and tell you, I tell you what you're going to do? No. That's not the way Jesus responded to people. In fact, just the opposite. And yet, in so many circles, that's what a real man will do. Bow up, you know, get his chest all out, point his finger, raise his fist, raise his voice in anger. But that's not biblical manhood. Now, this isn't to say that Jesus was weak or he didn't have strong character or he didn't stand for the truth or did not press his opponents. He did all of those things. He stood for truth. He pressed his opponents. He argued for truth. And yet he did this always maintaining these qualities. Now, I admire a true gentle man. I think I've known some in my lifetime. Men who I consider truly gentle men. I don't mean gentleman in the sense that he opens a door for a lady or he's willing to get up in the doctor's waiting room for a woman that needs a place to sit. No, those things are good, and maybe we ought to do those things. But I'm talking about a true gentle man in this respect. Oh, they live in the truth. They stand for the truth. They teach the truth. They correct in truth. But in doing that, they are always able to maintain a gentle, humble, lowly, and meek disposition. That's a real man. The opposite, the very opposite of what the world is teaching our boys to be. All right, that's the first passage. The second passage is found over in Hebrews chapter 7. Obviously, this is not a description of Jesus, made by Jesus of himself. This is made by the writer of Hebrews. And the idea that he's establishing here is that Jesus is eminently qualified to serve as high priest. And so that's the context. He's trying to establish Jesus' qualifications as high priest. And in order to do that, he emphasizes Jesus' character, highlights several qualities. We're going to look at just four in verse 26. Hebrews 7, verse 26. For it was fitting for us to have such a high priest. And so that's what he's establishing. Jesus is high priest. And it's certainly proper and appropriate for us to have Jesus as serving as our high priest. For it was fitting for us to have such a high priest, holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. And so we're going to look at those first four or so. Jesus is holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners. All these are, I think, more or less synonyms in this passage. There might be shades of difference between the words, but all of them are highlighting and emphasizing Jesus' non-participation in sinful conduct. He's holy. He doesn't participate in sinful conduct. In fact, that's the whole point, that he's not a sinner who has to make a sacrifice for himself first before he can offer sacrifices for the people. He's a holy man. He's innocent. He, as far as sin is concerned, he's undefiled. He's separated from sinners. We're going to talk a little bit about holiness in just a moment, but it's interesting, Romans 16 and verse 18, there the word innocent is used in connection with the danger of false teachers who by their persuasive words are able to influence the minds of the unsuspecting. The innocent. Those who are innocent in their thinking. And so they're unsuspecting. Some versions will say harmless instead of innocent. Jesus is undefiled. He's unstained. James 1 verse 27. Pure religion and undefiled before our God and Father is this, to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. And so all of these are synonyms, holy, innocent as far as sin is concerned, undefiled as far as sin is concerned. Again, they emphasize Jesus' non-participation in sinful conduct. The idea that he's separated from sinners doesn't mean that he did not associate with sinners. We know that Jesus was a friend of sinners. He was criticized for his association with sinners. And so when we say he's separated from sinners, it's not that he stood aloof and said, okay, you sinners over there, I'm staying over here. No, he got in amongst the sinners trying to teach them. But he didn't participate with them in their sinful conduct. And so the book of Hebrews even emphasizes that he was tempted in all points as we are, yet without sin. And Peter says he did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth. If something is holy, it's been set apart for God's use. When I was growing up, I learned that holy meant to be set apart. Well, that lacks an important element. Set apart for God's use. All right, so that makes a thing holy. God is the holy God in that he's separated in every respect from other so-called gods. He's separate from us. He is transcendent. Sometimes we use that word. He's not to be equated with any created thing, whether sun or moon or stars or animal or man. And so he is transcendent. He's beyond and other than all of those things. It also describes his moral excellence. So the Habakkuk chapter 1 verse 13 says, your eyes are too pure to approve evil, and you cannot look on wickedness with favor. And so he's apart from whatever is wicked and unholy. God's people are to possess this quality as well. We are called holy ones or saints. We are to be separate from the world and the lust and pride that's in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the vainglory or the pride of life is of the world. And we are to not be influenced or affected or stained by that. We are to be holy as God is holy, 1 Peter 1, verse 14, and pure as God is pure, 1 John 3 and verse 3, and righteous as God is righteous, 1 John 3 and verse 7. Jesus, of course, is the greatest example of a holy man. In Mark chapter 1 and verse 24, he's called the Holy One of God. He is holy in word, in deed, and thought. And so there is no lust in Jesus' thoughts. There's no pride. There's no envy. There's no malice. There's no profane word. There's no lascivious talk or action. There's no lying. There's no stealing. There is only honesty and purity, respect for authority, including his parents. Luke chapter 2, verse 52. He lived to do God's will, not his own will. John 6 and verse 38. He prayed. He attended worship. You know, his custom was to go to the synagogue on the Sabbath day. He prayed. He attended worship. He spread the gospel. He is a holy man, set apart from all others for God's use. And so, boys, if you want to develop into a real man, you need to learn holiness. You need to be innocent and pure. Parents, if you want to raise a boy to be a man, teach him how to be holy and innocent and undefiled and separated from sinners. Now, unfortunately, we live in a world where these qualities are not highly prized. Many believe that a real man is just the opposite of these things. He is unholy. He is impure. He is a sinner. He is not innocent. In fact, he would consider it an insult if someone said, well, you're innocent. You're just an innocent boy, you know. You're inexperienced. And that goes for women in our world as well. There are many people who believe that a woman, a young girl who is inexperienced in the ways of the world, well, that's an insult. And so what the world is teaching our young people, our men and women, our boys and girls, is to be the very opposite of these things. Well, a real man in the sight of God, who we're trying to please God, is holy, innocent, undefiled, and separated from sinners. One other passage, 1 Peter chapter 2. And Jesus is, or Peter is teaching us to follow the example of Jesus. That's what he says in verse 21. You've been called for this purpose since Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps. So follow in the steps of Jesus. He committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. While being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And so when Jesus was being reviled, well, what did he do? When Jesus was being threatened, when he was suffering, when these things were being inflicted upon him, how did he respond? Well, let's just think about that a little bit. Jesus suffered abuse throughout his lifetime, or throughout his ministry at any rate, and it escalated until he was crucified. He was accused of being a friend of sinners. They meant that as an insult. We take that as a compliment, but they meant that as an insult. He was born of fornication. That's the accusation that was made. He was a sinner. He was demon-possessed. He was falsely accused. He was insulted, lied about, mocked, ridiculed, slapped, spit on, arrested, beaten, crucified as a common criminal. And what was his reaction to all of these things? Like a sheep that is silent before its shearer, so he did not open his mouth. Isaiah 53, verse 7. In fact, he was so peaceful in his response that Pilate marveled at him. Matthew chapter 27, verses 11 through 14. Again, Pilate is so taken by Jesus' lack of, you know, resistance. You know, he didn't fight back. He didn't argue back. He didn't insult in return. Pilate says in verse 13, don't you hear how many things they testify against you? Don't you hear what they're saying about you? And he did not answer him with regard to even a simple charge, so the governor was quite amazed. Not only did he not respond physically or violently when he was insulted and threatened and abused, he told his disciples not to. Peter, you put that sword back in its sheath. That's not what we're about. Matthew 26, verse 52. That's a paraphrase, of course. And so Jesus did not respond in kind, even while on the cross. They cursed him, but he didn't curse them. He didn't threaten them. He didn't fight. He didn't raise his voice in anger. He didn't raise his fists. What he did say is, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. He entrusted himself to him who judges righteously. God will sort all this out in his way, in his time, and he'll get it exactly right. What should a man do? What should a man do if he's insulted, if he's mocked, if he's ridiculed, if he's treated the way Jesus was treated? Jesus says, if they strike you on one cheek, turn to him the other also. He should have the strength of character not to respond in kind. Well, it's pretty, that's challenging teaching, isn't it? I think we got a manhood problem in our country. We're teaching our young men to be materialistic and aggressive and violent. We're teaching them to be disrespectful for women or of women, disrespectful to authority, self-indulgent to excess. The very opposite of the qualities Jesus, the ideal man, possessed. Again, this is radically counter-cultural teaching, maybe at its best. But if we want to be a real man in God's sight, well, these are the qualities that we will develop. I hope that I maybe have helped us to begin to think about these things as we develop into young men and as we raise our boys to be young men. These are the qualities that we want to instill in them. If you're here today, not a Christian, we'll give you an opportunity to respond to the invitation. If you've put your faith in Jesus as the Christ, if you're ready to repent and be baptized, now is the time. If you're already a Christian but not faithful to the Lord in your service, repent of the sin that's in your life. Confess it. God will forgive and begin once again to serve Him faithfully. If we can help you, we invite you to come as we stand and sing together.